Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 328 for August 7, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
When the process is complete, we're left with a liquid which is known as wash. But the problem is really that at this point, it's only about 8% alcohol. So, I mean, up to here, it's pretty much like we've made strong beer. Although you're from the US, so, I mean, it's pretty much like we've made really strong beer, you know?
Oh, be nice.
But basically, I mean, at this point, it's not strong enough to be a whiskey.
That's Christopher Goggins winding me up just a bit during a tour of the old Jameson Distillery in Dublin. It was 40 years ago this year that the old distillery closed down. Next year will mark the 15th anniversary of its revival as a tourist destination. Nearly a quarter of a million people visit the old distillery every year, and you'll get a private tour in a few minutes. I'll also have the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First off, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Back in May, we heard about the Single Oak Project from Buffalo Trace. Now, the second batch of 12 bottles is on its way to a few select whiskey retailers. If you need a quick refresher, the Single Oak Project took 96 carefully selected trees. Each tree produced two barrels, one from the top half of the tree and one from the bottom. Each of the 192 barrels was filled with either a wheat or rye recipe bourbon and stored in one of two warehouses for the same amount of time. The idea was to figure out what influence unique variables had on each of the barrels, with nearly 1,400 potential variations. Buffalo Trace plans to release a new set from 12 different barrels every 3 months for the next 4 years. Each case contains one bottle from each of the 12 barrels. The results of this year's International Wine and Spirits Competition are in. Whiskies from 14 different countries earned medals in this year's competition. The best of the best, the winners of this year's IWSC trophies. Suntory's Yamazaki 18 won the Worldwide Whiskey Trophy. Edrington Group's Kingdom 30-Year-Old won the Blended Scotch Whiskey Independence Trophy. Among single malts, Benriach's Sherrywood 12-Year-Old won two trophies. Best Single Malt Scotch under 15 years old and Best Special Edition Single Malt Scotch. The Balvenie 30-Year-Old won the trophy for Best Single Malt over 15 years old. And the Glenlivet Founders Reserve 21-Year-Old won the trophy for Best Cask Strength Single Malt. There's a link to the complete list of award winners at the Whiskey Cast website. Only a handful of new releases to mention this week. First off, Douglas Lang & Company has 7 new old malt cask bottlings, including a 34-year-old Glenlivet, 21-year-olds from Laphroaig and Tamnavoulin, and a 15-year-old from Erin. The Lang brothers also have single grain whiskies from Cambus and Cameron Bridge bottled under their Clandenny label, and a new 46-year-old version of their Speyside's finest single malt. The distillery can't be named, but I've tasted several previous bottlings in the Speyside's Finest series, and it's one you're likely to be familiar with. Finally, the latest release in the Double Barrel series from the Lang Brothers pairs up casks from Laphroaig and Mortlach. It joins previous Double Barrel releases teaming up McAllen and Laphroaig, Highland Park and Beaumont, and the most recent one, a batting of casks from Kalila and Braval. I've mentioned the Lion's Pride craft whiskies from Chicago's Koval Distillery before, but until now all of them have been single-grain whiskies. Distiller Robert Berniker is trying something new, a four-grain whiskey made from malted barley, rye, oats, and wheat. It's named the 47th Ward Blend and will debut this week at Fountainhead in Chicago, which is located in the 47th Ward. The 47th Ward blend isn't likely to be around for long. There are just 166 bottles available in the first batch. Finally, Australian whiskey lovers are getting something new, all the way from Kentucky. Australia's ASM Liquors has acquired some bourbon stock and is releasing Rocking Angel Kentucky Bourbon. No word on which distillery the whiskey came from, but it's said to be about 3 years old. Now, I know we have a lot of Whiskey Cast community members in Australia. If any of you get a chance to try this one, please post some tasting notes for the rest of us on the Whiskey Cast Facebook page. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Still time to enter the contest to win a trip to the Glenmorangie Distillery in Scotland and meet some of the 16 men of Tain, and you and a guest will get to stay at Glenmorangie House, too. Just visit the Glenmorangie Facebook page for more details. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well made. Time now for the comments of the week, brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. This is Whiskey Fringe Weekend in Edinburgh, Scotland, and we got a field report from John Michael Burns on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page. Had a great day yesterday at Whiskey Fringe Edinburgh. Great range of malts sampled and some very interesting and informative discussions with Hugh at the Douglas Lang stand, including the stratospheric pricing for some rather unextraordinary 30-year-old malts. Only downside was that my palate gave up the ghost after about an hour, even with spitting out, water rinsing, etc. John, thank you for the details, and if you're attending a whiskey event anywhere in the world, be sure to tell us about it on the Facebook page. I try to post a couple of photos every week on the Facebook page, just for fun. This week I posted a panoramic shot of Lagavulin Distillery on Islay that I shot last year during the Islay Festival. Got a lot of comments on it, including this one from Christopher Winters in Indiana. These photos of yours would look fantastic in my new home bar. Just finished framing an old 1963 picture of the workers at Talisker. Well, that's a photo I'd like to see. Last time around, I mentioned Mike Walsh's request for help in finding good whiskey bars in the Cleveland area. I'm pleased to report that the WhiskeyCast community has come through yet again. J. Leslie Wheelock is a brand ambassador for the Edrington Group in Canada. One of his connections came through with several recommendations in Cleveland. I've posted them on the Facebook page and passed them along to Mike, too. And Mike says, thank you for the help. Now, if you have a question, suggestion, or even a bar recommendation, you can always post it on the Facebook page or just email me directly. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com, and the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com, where you can become a whiskey insider today. Let's check out the calendar of events now, brought to you as always by Laphroaig. Added a bunch of new events to the calendar this week. Richard Patterson of White & Mackay has several events in the Northeast U.S. this coming week, including a tasting on Tuesday at Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts. Ward 3 in New York City will host a release party for the U.S. debut of Great King Street from Compass Box on August 22nd. More on Great King Street later on. Gordon & McPhail's Michael Urquhart will host tastings of the Glenlivet Generations range at the Kensington Wine Market in Calgary, Alberta, August 25th and 26th. Jim McEwen's tasting at the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society's Vaults in Leith, Scotland on the 25th is sold out now, but there are still tickets available for the tasting with Laphroaig's John Campbell on August 31st. Also on the 25th, the Irish Whiskey Society will hold a tasting of Tyrconnell Irish Whiskies at the Brooks Hotel in Dublin. And Whiskey Live Taipei is August 27th and 28th, followed by Whiskey Live Shanghai September 2nd and 3rd. There's an entire year's worth of whiskey events at the calendar on the WhiskeyCast website. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. The all-new Laphroaig website is up now, including a completely redesigned Friends of Laphroaig area. Become a friend of Laphroaig today and claim your own square foot of Islay. Forty years ago, one of Ireland's oldest distilleries closed, the John Jameson & Sons Distillery on Bow Street, just a couple of blocks away from the River Liffey that runs through downtown Dublin, had been producing whiskey for nearly 200 years. The spirit of John Jameson's legacy lives on Bow Street, though. What survived of the old distillery reopened in 1997 as a visitor's center devoted to maintaining that legacy. Recently, I visited the old distillery and got a private tour from Christopher Goggins. It's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth.
Jameson Whiskey was founded here about 230 years ago, back in 1780, by a man from Alloa in Scotland called John Jameson. Moved over here in the late 1770s, founded the distillery here in 1780, and then made it here for the very, very first time. So this is a... to pardon the pun, the spiritual home of Jameson, you know. So it was produced here for the first time, continued to be produced here up till 1971, and that was when we closed the doors of the distillery here and moved to our newer, larger, and more modern distillery down in Middleton, down in Cork. And since then, every drop of Jameson sold worldwide has been coming from the distillery down there. So after moving away from here, we abandoned pretty much all of the site, and this is the one remaining building that's still standing today. So what we show people on the tour here is a recreation of the old-fashioned process.
How much of the old building and the old distillery is left? Because I know that there's a lot of new development, new construction around here.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, there are a few of the older buildings still standing in and around, but this is the one that's still in our possession. You know, anything else would have been taken over by various other companies over the years.
How much of it is left? What was done in this building?
This originally was the fermentation building at the distillery, which is something we'll be talking about a little more on the tour as we go around. But this is, as far as I'm aware, the only one that we're still in possession of. In terms of exactly how many buildings there are still standing, I'm not 100% sure, I have to say.
Why did they decide to move out of downtown Dublin?
You've actually kind of answered the question for yourself there a little bit, because obviously trying to get raw materials and ingredients in and then whiskey out in what was becoming a much busier city centre was becoming increasingly difficult for us. And also the fact that there was just a larger scope for expansion down at the distillery in Middleton, just with the increasing demand for Jameson space, was becoming an issue. And obviously in city centre Dublin, space is always at a premium. So it just made more sense long term to move to somewhere a little more, with a little more scope for that.
Now the doors here closed in 1971, and this reopened as a visitor centre in 97. What happened during the interim?
Very little. The visitor centre was based literally right across the street from here in something that has also since been redeveloped, and that was called the Irish Whiskey Corner, which kind of took people around the history of not just Jameson, but Irish whiskey as a whole in basically one little room. And obviously as visitor numbers increased, we again needed something larger to deal with that. So in 97, we redeveloped this building into a working visitor centre. And then in 2007, we closed for a further 3 months and invested about another $6 million into the visitor centre to create what you'll be seeing on the tour now in a few minutes.
And how many visitors do you get through here in a year?
It's becoming more difficult to say again, because obviously with the economic climate that we have, but usually we're averaging about 250,000 people through the doors here every year.
And that's down because of the recession a bit?
It's something that has kind of steadied out for us now again, and we are noticing it starting to pick up for us again a little bit, absolutely. But, I mean, like with any industry, we were hit by it a little bit, yeah.
How much fun is it to work here?
As a whiskey drinker, as a Jameson drinker especially, this is kind of my dream job, you know what I mean, in terms of just being able to spread the word and get information out there about it. You know, I like that with the tour here especially, there's no... I'm trying to think what the word is. There's no sort of candy coating. We're not here to market to people. We've got a good whiskey with a good story and a great taste. And it sort of sells itself, which makes my job that little bit easier too, you know.
Did you have any family connections to the whiskey business?
I did not. In fact, my first whiskey experience was actually bourbon, which they hate when I tell, but my parents were both big bourbon drinkers. And the first time I came here as a visitor myself during the comparative tasting that we'll be doing a little later, I actually chose the bourbon as my favorite, which I've liked to keep on the down low ever since. But
I don't think we're going to tell anybody about this, but we'll see. But there are some bourbon casks that go into Jameson too, right?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. About 95% of the casks that we use are ex-bourbon casks coming over from Kentucky, yeah.
So there's a little bit of a link there.
There's a connection, absolutely.
We've moved into the old grain store, and this was the actual grain store, right?
Well, as I said, this is a recreation. So what we've done here is we've used actual beams and pieces from a disused warehouse down at Middleton. So this would be a recreation using original structures, but obviously very much still a recreation, you know. But this is where we would have stored the essential ingredients. So still two very, very strict rules regarding ingredients today. Firstly is that it's Irish barley and only Irish barley. But secondly is that we do like to keep quite local control on what we're using. So every grain, or every barley grain, I should say, going into Jameson is sourced from within about 50 to 75 kilometres of the distillery in Cork today. It's just that if you're going to get decent weather and decent barley growing weather anywhere in this country, the sunny southwest, as they call it, is always the place to get it, you know. On a personal note, it's also part of the reason why I believe we moved to Middleton originally as well, because obviously long term it would be cheaper to move Jameson to the ingredients than to continue moving the ingredients to Jameson, so to speak, you know. But the barley stores, like for the two centuries we spent in Dublin, they were actually considered the most important buildings that we owned, because really, for reasons only known to himself, John made the decision back very early into the company that we should buy in advance. So every September in and around harvest season, we'd actually buy enough barley to provide for a full production season, which during his tenure would have been a 6-month production season between October and March of every year. And I mean, if you consider, now these are very approximate figures, but I believe that for every 3 bottles of Jameson, we need approximately a kilo of grain. I mean, we had huge quantities of barley here at the distillery. So the distillery itself, it covered about 7 acres or about like 10 football fields. And we had to dedicate a little over half of all of that property just to the barley stores, you know. But it's sort of, it's your jumping off point, you know. The moment you've got all of this in stock, everything else can start from there, you know. And the first step we'll be talking about this morning is called malting. And we'll be talking about that up the stairs. Okay. Whiskey nerd on things and going into way more detail than people ever need, but you know,
it's fine.
So, I'll be using the 2 screens here now a little bit. If you can get a clear picture of them, I don't know. But right. So this is something I like to tell every group at this point before we get started, you know. But a lot of people start noticing through the tour that, you know, a lot of the details and the aspects and just the little things you have to do when you're making a whiskey, they seem so small that they couldn't possibly be significant, you know? But what I sort of strive to get across to people is that it's actually those little things that can make the difference between a whiskey and a great whiskey, you know? So for Jameson, the first one of those little things that people need to get their head around is that we start production with 2 very slightly different kinds of barley. So the way that it works is basically that we go down into the store and we divide all of our barley in 2. So one specific percentage is just regular, ordinary, normal barley, and that's going to go directly into production. And then the other percentage, and just again on a personal note, what I consider the more important percentage, it comes here for what's called the malting process, which I mean is an essential step, but actually a very, very simple technique. So just to explain how it works, you're going to take some of your barley out of the store. You're just going to soak it in water for about 2 days. And then after emerging it for those 2 days, you take the wet grains and send them to what's called a malt house, which is just a warm and humid building, which you'll see here in just a moment, where you spread the grains out over the floor and you store them for about 5 days. And obviously during that time, in the sort of spring-like conditions of the malt house, the grains will start to sprout or to germinate, you know. And then after about 5 days in the malt houses, the germinating grains are going to be transferred to the building, which is usually located right next door, and that's known as a kiln, which is the Gaelic word for an oven. And what you do here is simply light a fire down on the ground floor. And then up on the first floor, you spread the barley over what's called a perforated floor, which looks just like this. So the heat of the fire would just rise up through the kiln, pass through the little holes in the floor, and on average it takes between usually 24 and 30 hours, but it dries the grains off. And that's all it is, you know? It's just dried germinating barley. That's malt, okay? So, I mean, again, it's one of those little things, one of those little details of the process, but it's also the biggest difference between Jameson and most Scotch whiskey. And that's very simply, the difference is just the fuel in the fire. Because John made the decision back in the very first day that he wanted to change things up a little bit. You know, he had new ideas and new techniques he wanted to bring in, and one of those was to burn a smokeless fuel. So he originally had to travel to Wales and imported a coal called anthracite. The only difference today is that we use natural gas, but the essential point is that it's smoke-free, and it means that it's only the heat that dries the malt. Now, over in Scotland, I mean, obviously, it's pretty much exactly the same idea, but by and large, they burn peat or turf. I mean, some places even burn wood, so it's not just the heat, but you get the smoke blowing up through the kiln as well, and that's what imparts a lot of Scotch whiskey, now not all, but a lot of Scotch whiskey with that more pronounced smoky, peaty aroma and taste. It's completely absent in Jameson, and it's something we're going to talk about some more when we do that comparative tasting a little bit later on, okay? But really what we do now is it's the big company secret, you know, and that's the mixture, because we're going to use a certain amount of malted barley, a certain amount of that regular unmalted barley, and we combine the two in a very specific proportion, you know? And for each different Jameson that we make, it has its own, I mean, shall we say, recipe in terms of the malted and unmalted that goes in there, but that's a very, very tightly guarded secret, you know? And basically then we take that mixture, we send it to the mill, and that'll be the next stop this morning, okay?
Okay.
Cool. And if you want to check it out here, there's a sample of malt. The smell is incredible, so feel free to check that out if you'd like.
Mm.
Yeah, that kind of biscuity, vanilla kind of quality coming out. Right then. So again, not a lot to explain here, but we take that precise mix, the malted and unmalted barley, send it to the mill. In the old days, obviously, it was a water-powered millstone kind of setup, so the grains would go between the two stones, the wheel would start to turn, the stones would start to turn, and the grains would be crushed and ground down into a flour, like you can see here, called grist. And that grist then goes to the next stop, okay?
Okay.
So again, if you want to check that out, you can feel free. Just out of your own interest then as well, over here, this was our steam-powered engine that was brought in 1886 just as a backup power source. And the original engine actually is on display out at the engineering building at UCD. And finally then, what you see here is actually one of our original millstones. This is 231 years old and rumored to bring good luck if you touch it, so... Knock yourself out, okay?
Were they using water from the river for to run the wheels?
That's always been a question I've been looking for the exact answer to. As far as I'm aware, and from the research I've done myself, the mill was the one thing that wasn't actually based on the grounds of the distillery here. It was done a little further out of town where there was a bit more current in the river. I'm not sure if you've seen the Liffey in this part of town, but It's quite still at this point. There's not much of a current there. So it's actually one thing on the tour that I don't have an exact answer to, but I believe it was the one thing that wasn't based on the grounds of the distillery here back at the time. And actually the same applies to the distillery down at Middleton today as well. The milling is actually done off-site.
Okay. How long did it take you to learn all this?
This is something that's been, it's an ongoing project for me more than anything else. You know, there's obviously a script that we're given that we have to learn at the start, but for me that was very much a jumping off point. Like, I've gone kind of above and beyond trying to learn more, as much information as I possibly can, for precisely the reason that people would never catch me out on a question, but you've just completely disproved that for me, you know what I mean? I can fire this up if you'd like, but it is quite noisy.
No need.
All right, okay. So what we have here, this is what's called, obviously a scaled-down version, but it's what's known as a mash tun. This is quite scaled down. Like, down at the modern distillery, I'm sure this is something you'll see when you're on your tour down there, the mash tuns are about twice the size of the room that we're actually standing in here. So essentially what we do here is we take the grist, the flour from the last stage, send it here, and then add hot water. That goes in at 63 Celsius or about 135 Fahrenheit. So, I mean, hot, but not boiling. And then the blades that you see here would rotate around the machine, just stir the grist through the water for the next 4 hours. And basically what's happening during that time is that the starches that exist in the flour naturally are going to be broken down into fermentable sugars. And obviously, I mean, we need sugar for fermentation. We need fermentation for alcohol. And I mean, in this country, like, alcohol-free anything is really not very popular. So you could really say this is one of the most essential steps of the tour, you know, or of the process, I should say. Now, after 4 hours, essentially, you've got two things here. So first up, there's the liquid, which is known as wort. So very hot, but full of that natural sugar. And the floor of the machine is almost like a strainer. So we can open it up. The liquid would drain through and it's pumped onto the next step. And then the grist, or what's now known as spent grain, is trapped inside the machine. And it's useless to Jameson at this stage. So the leftover grist is actually processed and then sold as animal food. But the important detail, obviously, is the liquid. So it's transferred now to what's known as a washback, which is just the industry term for a fermentation vat. And that'll be the next official stop on the tour today. But there's just a little something I want to show you first. So check this out. It's just, Mark, I'm not sure if you got much of a chance when you came in down at reception to check this out. But down around our ground floor, you can see these huge glass panels in the floor.
Right.
With that circular stone structure going on underneath it. Now, originally, this particular building, like we mentioned downstairs, this was the fermentation building. So it would have been filled with vessels like the ones you see back here called washbacks. But again, the one we have on display here isn't even a tenth of the real size. Like, in reality, they're about 25 meters or 80 feet high.
Right.
They can hold about 200,000 liters of liquid. So we discovered that obviously because of their size and weight and volume, we had to build stone supports to hold them in place. And so that's what you see downstairs at reception. Those are the original stone foundations from the first day. So again, it's worth a closer look. If you get the chance after the tour, try and check that out again if you get a moment, okay?
So those are the beams underneath and then the original stone supports that you can see through the glass?
Precisely, yeah. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So what we do here then is we take the wort, send it to the washback, add what's called distiller's yeast into the mixture, and that then is how fermentation starts. So, as I'm sure you're well aware, fermentation would be the reaction between the yeast and the sugar, and it slowly converts all of the sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide. Now, it's quite a slow process. Like, even today, this takes roughly 80 hours, a little over 3 days. But when the process is complete, we're left with a liquid which is known as wash. But the problem is really that at this point, it's only about 8% alcohol. So, I mean, up to here, it's pretty much like we've made strong beer. Although you're from the US, so, I mean, it's pretty much like we've made really strong beer, you know?
Oh, be nice.
but basically, I mean, at this point, it's not strong enough to be a whiskey. But at 8% alcohol, it's just about strong enough to keep the process moving. So what we do at this stage is take that wash, that sort of beer-like liquid, send it through for distillation, and convert it into something that looks a little bit more like whiskey. All right?
Now, one of the things you've done is actually take the original walls that housed the washbacks and used those to put some of the rooms in for the visitor center.
Very much so, yeah, absolutely. So as I said, I mean, the original structure has remained intact insofar as possible, but in certain areas of the tour, as you'll see as we go through, we have used pieces and recreations from actual washbacks and spirit vats and various.
I'm talking about these walls here that actually housed the original washbacks, like the round walls here.
Oh, absolutely.
That's
what
I'm talking about. You've actually been able to take those and with the one over here, cut into it and turn it into part of the tour, but actually be able to reuse as much of the original structure was left.
Exactly. Yeah. Very much so. Very much so.
Okay.
All right. So distillation, that'll be our next stop this morning. And this, again, it's a technique I'm sure you're quite familiar with, but we'll break it down anyways. So, I mean, and this is putting it in its most black and white terms, because obviously a lot of the tours that we'd operate here would be for very much whiskey rookies, you know. But distillation, I mean, in its simplest terms is just I wouldn't say the simple separation, but the separation of the alcohol and the water. And obviously the art of the distiller is knowing the exact moments, knowing the exact elements of the alcohol that he's looking for. So this is where our triple distillation technique really comes into its own. So the copper vessels that you see here, essentially, they're just huge kettles, but in the industry, they're referred to as pot stills. So we send the wash to the first and largest pot still, which is known simply as the wash still. We light a fire underneath, and that's something we control with gas now as well, so it's that little bit more accurate today, you know. We just start to heat it up. Now, the beauty of distillation and the whole idea behind this technique is that alcohol and water have two very different boiling points. So, I mean, as everybody knows, water boils at 100 Celsius. But alcohol is actually going to boil first. It actually starts to boil off at 78.3 degrees. So the trick here is to heat it, but then as soon as it hits that point, you got to hold the temperature exactly there. Because what we find is that most of the water remains in the still, it's left behind. But the boiling alcohol becomes obviously an alcoholic vapor. So it rises up from the water, passes to the top of the still. And I'm sorry that it's not visible here, but the top of that still would be connected over here to a structure known as a condenser. So once the vapor eventually arrives there, it's the condenser's job to cool it all back down again, so it cools the steam back to liquid. And basically that's, in essence, one distillation done. So the resulting liquid from that is called low wines. It's going to be transferred to the second still, and literally we just repeat exactly the same process over again. And then the resulting liquid second time round, which is known as faints, will go on to the third still. And that's, one of the key differences, okay? Because we distill everything that we make in the same way for a third time. Now, I am the first person to admit to people and to every visitor we have that there are exceptions to this. You know, there's so many whiskies out there now that there are no black and white rules anymore. But back in the day, this was considered to be the second big difference. Because, I mean, even now, a lot of American whiskey is still only distilled one time. Most Scotch and Canadian and most other whiskey worldwide is usually two distillations. But because we go again, it's like an extra refinement or another purification of the whiskey. So that's what makes the difference for Jameson and gives it that softer and smoother and more mellow quality. Or as marketing always likes us to say, a triple distilled to be twice as smooth for one great taste, you know? Yeah. So basically two quick things to ask you to remember at this stage. I mean, firstly is that, as I'm sure you're aware, like after distillation, it looks like water. It doesn't get that golden color until later into the process, okay? But secondly is that we have had quite a major increase in terms of the alcoholic strength here. So we've gone from a liquid at 8% alcohol going into this process to a young whiskey coming out of the third still at 82%, which, I mean, even if you're Irish, is kind of strong. So we have to add pure water, okay? It's called deionized water. I mean, back in the day, it would have been distilled and demineralized as best as possible, but it's deionized water today. It's not going to impact on the flavor whatsoever. It's just going to bring it down to the correct level for the next stage of the process. And just, we found that for Jameson, the exact level should be 63.4% alcohol. So we cut it back to that level. We fill up our barrels. We send our barrels into a warehouse, and then that'll be the next stop this morning, and we'll have a talk about the maturation cycle.
And you've actually been able to reuse some still pieces in here from other old former Irish distilleries,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. What you're seeing here is actually stills and our spirit safer from the sadly now defunct Coleraine distillery up in Northern Ireland. So these would have been, I mean, quite small stills, obviously, to begin with, but everything you're seeing here they were actual working stills, absolutely.
Including the spirit safe as well?
Exactly, yes.
close.
You know, what we show people on the tour is a recreation. You know, it's the way, the old-fashioned and traditional way to make a whiskey. But again, what I kind of like to stop and just remind people of here is that everything I've shown you today, it's exactly the same techniques as we're using down at the Modern Distillery. You know, we've tried to remain as loyal as possible to every technique that John introduced when he first started things off. So while this all has been a recreation of the traditional process, it's how it's done now. It's obviously that just at the distillery today, it's a more automatic and more technological version of it. But what I always like to stress to people here at this stop is that no matter what the future might do to the rest of the process, this is the one section that can never be touched, you know, because what you see in here represents actually the two biggest influences on any whiskey's flavor, and that's just the length of time that you let it age and the type of wood that you make the barrels with. And so obviously the one thing that throws up at Jameson is that we just have to be absolutely meticulous about choosing the wood that we're going to use, because it genuinely doesn't really matter how careful you've been with everything else. This is make or break time, you know. If you get the wrong type of wood, you are going to get the wrong flavor of whiskey. So we have to be so specific about what we're using. And just before we talk about the exact type of wood that we use, the other reason that the wood represents such an important detail is that it's the wood that gives the color. It contains an element called tannin, which is going to be absorbed by the whiskey as it ages. And again, as a general rule, then usually the longer that a whiskey's aged, the slightly deeper the color turns out to be, you know? Now, in terms of the wood that we use, we're very, very specific about it. Now, we only ever use white oak. But the one thing that's quite unique about Jameson is that for every single whiskey that we use, it's never a brand new white oak barrel, because we believe that if you use new wood, it gives the whiskey a flavor that we consider that little bit too strong for Jameson. So to avoid that problem, we use what are called seasoned barrels, which means they're all imported, but more importantly, that they've all been used elsewhere at least once before. So we use three different types, and I'd say about 96% of our barrels look like the ones you can see around yourself here, Mark. We're using about 111,000 of these every year. They're imported from a cooperage in Kentucky in the US, where obviously they've been used once before all over the country for various different bourbons and American whiskies. So this represents the vast majority, but the other two that we use, you can see here. The slightly smaller, we're using about 3,500 to 4,000 of those per year. They come from Jerez de la Frontera in Spain, where they've been used for sherry. And then the very largest of all are reserved for one particular whiskey that we make called the Jameson Rarest Vintage. We're only using about 55 of those per year. They come from Portugal and they've been used once before for port wine. And so what's important to understand here is that, you see, because they've already been used, they're at least 2 years old by the time that we get them. So the freshness of the wood is not something that really impacts on Jameson. What impacts on Jameson is the fact that the wood, it's almost like a sponge. And so the bourbon or the sherry or the port actually left a little bit of residue soaked in. And obviously as the years goes by and Jameson starts to mature even further, that residue is going to start to escape. It's going to start to mix. And to some extent, particularly so in the case of the port and sherry barrels, it's going to have a bearing on the flavor of the whiskey. But it's exactly the impact we're looking for. Now, it's something we'll talk about a little more when we move into the next room. It's just, there's a few other things I want to show you here before we move on and talk about what we do after maturation. So just before we move and we talk about that a little further, I'll give you a quick look at this. And my apologies, because we do actually have one out of order right now. But this will just explain a little more clearly the development of the whiskey as it begins to age. So starting down at the bottom, and that's Jameson in year one. So the one that you had a smell from here, this is pretty much exactly what it would look like in there right now. Still very young. I mean, only really starting to take the tannin at that point. So it doesn't even really look like a whiskey yet. In the center, it's three. And just so that you know, by Irish law, that's the absolute minimum. You can't even call it whiskey in this country until it's 3 years old. So technically, we could bottle that up and sell it, but we prefer to go a little bit longer. So like even the original Jameson, which is the one you'll taste in the bar, it's a mix of whiskeys aged for between 4 and 7 years. We call it a five-year-old on average, okay? The next one I would normally show you here is how it looks after 5 years. I mean, the only real difference would be that the color would have developed a little bit more and the level would have dropped a little bit further. Hopefully that's something you're noticing with each barrel as we go by. And then up top, further from me, you've got the 12-year-old, obviously losing quite a considerable proportion of the whiskey here. And the final one you see then is 18 years of age, and we've lost about 30% of the whiskey at that stage. Now, the reason for this loss is just natural evaporation, a phenomenon they call the angel share. Costs about 2% of the whiskey every year. And I mean, it sounds like kind of a negligible figure, but 2% a year to Jameson, when you consider the amount we have in stock down there, it's actually working out at about 10,000 bottles of whiskey a day evaporating from the warehouses down there, you know? And just really the final points here to cover then is that, well, each barrel, it has a life of between 20 and 25 years. So we use all of our barrels a maximum of 3 times each. And really at that stage, then there's just not enough quality left in the wood to give Jameson the flavour that it needs. So a lot of our barrels then will be exported to various other spirit companies. And particularly a lot of them now are going to Cuba, where they're being used for rum after we're finished with them. So again, any byproducts that we have or anything left over after Jameson's production, we do like to try and recycle and reuse it insofar as we possibly can, you know.
Okay.
But really, I mean, at this stage when maturation's done, I don't like to say we've got a problem, because it's actually something we've done completely deliberately, but we do have one last hurdle to overcome, and the solution to that hurdle is our last stage, which is called marrying and vatting, and then we'll head for the bar. So we're nearly there this morning, Mark, all right? This way. Okay. And so just before we talk about that last step, I'll just give you a little look at some of the things you can see around the room here. Now, this is more so to do with our coopers. This always confuses people a little bit, because obviously we always imported our barrels, so we never truly had a team of barrel makers here. But the coopers at Jameson would have been kind of reassemblers, if you will. Because in the early days, we imported them kind of IKEA style, you know, like broken down and flat packed. Right. And then the coopers would be here to rebuild and to maintain them during their lifetime. Now, over the years, we discovered that by breaking the barrels down like that, we were actually losing a lot of that residue from the previous contents. And so today, they're all imported, fully assembled. And there's actually now, I believe, only 4 coopers working at the distillery down there just for quality control and for maintenance purposes, you know. But this was a thriving, thriving industry in Dublin back in the early days. And generally speaking, a trade that was passed down through your family as well. Now, the drawback of being a cooper for Jameson was that you had to train as an apprentice for 7 years. But the thing was then, when you became a master cooper, you could then pass the trade down through your family. And like 200 years ago in Ireland, if you could guarantee a future for your line, that was a pretty big deal. That was kind of the incentive of the job. So the only problem we had with that was obviously that Irish tradition of naming your first son after yourself. So we always had countless numbers of people here with exactly the same name. So on your first day at work, you were given your nickname and that was what they called you for your entire career. So some of them were a lot luckier than others. But if you do want to have a look at those, Mark, you can feel free to check them out. All right. So it brings us nicely up to the last step then, you see, because during the time in the barrel, this is going to touch on what we talked about right at the very start, about how the little things can have the biggest impact onto the whiskey. Right. So many little factors playing with the flavour of Jameson while it's in those barrels, you know, and we could talk about them for 2 weeks here, but just to give you the short list, I mean, you've got the different types of wood. Like, obviously, they're all made of white oak, but American white oak and Iberian white oak are slightly different woods, slightly different flavours. You got the different sizes and different shapes of the barrel, which, again, might seem irrelevant. But, you know, a bourbon barrel has 200 litres to influence, whereas a sherry or port barrel has 500 litres to influence, and that's going to have an impact. There's the different residues, the bourbon, the sherry, and the port. They are going to have an impact onto the flavour, but you also have to bear in mind that we reuse the barrels. So a first use gives a very different flavour to a second or a third use, and that's going to have a bearing. And some people believe as well the location of the barrel can have a slight impact as well. You know, if it's in a warehouse on one side versus a warehouse on the other, some people believe that can have a slight bearing on the flavour too. And the final thing really is something you might have noticed from the light-up barrels that I showed you back there as well. All of the American wood, it's very heavily burned and charred on the inside. The Spanish and Portuguese isn't. So obviously then that burnt wood will have an impact on the flavour as well. But, I mean, once you get your head around all those little things, it actually works out pretty simply. I mean, for Jameson, the bourbon barrels, they tend to give quite a toasted vanilla quality into the whiskey. The sherry barrels, I mean, it's subtle, but it's a slightly sweeter quality, almost a honey flavour. And the port barrels, for the whiskies that we use them for, gives a much deeper and fruitier quality into the whiskey. So obviously what we have to do now is go back to the warehouses. And again, we have a recipe. You know, for each different Jameson that we make, there's an exact number of barrels that we have to find. So an exact number of bourbon, sherry, port, first use, second use, third use, some from one warehouse, some from another. Like, the attention to detail is incredible here. But the 500 that are selected are going to be emptied into a huge wooden vat and just left there for the next 4 days to mix, or what we call in Ireland to marry. And so it means that after 4 days in there, the different qualities of the different whiskies will balance, and the resulting Jameson has that uniformity, that same color, same aroma, but that complex mix, that depth of flavor every time that we make it. And that's something we're going to move in to talk about right now. Okay. Just, I guess, the final detail then is that the alcoholic strength is still a little bit too high, so we add more of that pure water to bring it to 40%. We send it to the bottling factory, which is the one thing still based in Dublin here, actually. That's done in Clondalkin, a little outside of the city centre. And then once they're full, we're just waiting for people like you to come along and empty them, you know? So if you're ready for the challenge, then we'll hit the bar, yeah?
Okay.
All right, cool. So, first up, can I get you a drink from here? Or would you like to just make your way directly over to the comparative tasting? We do offer a few different options here in terms of having it straight up or with certain mixers. We do it with cranberry juice, with ginger ale, or with Sprite.
Oh, let's just go straight to the comparative tasting.
All right, no worries. Well, this will be an option for you later on.
Oh, okay.
Dee, we just hear you.
Yeah.
Excellent, thank you. All right, so Mark, if you want to take a seat here. Get some water. All right.
Okay.
Sitting comfortably? Oh. And sitting upright, yeah. We'll see how you're doing afterwards, you know. Right. So what we're going to do here is what we finish all of our tours with. Now, normally we'd have a group of, say, at full capacity, a group of 35 people doing the tour. Everybody gets a drink from the bar, but then we select 8 volunteers from each group to do this slightly more detailed whiskey tasting here as well. So what we do with this is we compare 3 of the best-selling brands worldwide. So we're comparing Jameson, which is the best-selling Irish whiskey in the world, to, on the left, you've got the best-selling brand of Scotch, and on the right, the best-selling brand of American whiskey. And we just try and teach people a little more about the, you know, the small changes made along the way that can completely change the flavour of a whiskey. So it's just to get that point across a little further again. So a few just quick things I want to explain to you before we begin. Firstly is that we've added just a tiny amount of water into each whiskey, and that is recommended. It just helps to open the flavor up that little bit more clearly, but literally we're talking 2-3 drops of water added to each. It's not a huge amount. It's not to water the flavor down. It's quite the opposite. It's actually to open the flavor up a little better. Secondly is that they're all in the correct positions, so I'm not about to blindfold you and ask you to guess which is which or anything at all like that. All you're going to do for me here this morning, Mark, is try them, compare them, and then give me an honest opinion as to which one you like best, okay? And it's, you know, there's absolutely no pressure. If it turns out you prefer the Scotch or the American, then feel free to choose the Scotch or the American. We're not going to call security or anything like that. It's fine. And I guess just the final thing here is that you're going to be tasting them a few times each. So just little sips of each one as we're going along, and then finish them off at the end if you want to, okay? So we start with a drink of water just to cleanse the palate. You want to purge any of those non-whiskey flavors out of there first, you know? And then when you're all set, we'll start with the Jameson. So when you're ready, take your Jemmy. And we do the same thing every time. Nice long smell to start with. Breathe it in as deeply as you can. Because people underestimate that point. But when you're talking about the flavor of a whiskey, you're talking about the aroma as much as you are about the actual taste itself. So it's very important to breathe it in first. When you're all set then, you can take just a little sip. And I always advise people to try to hold it there for about 5 seconds before they swallow. Because again, a lot of people do find that with that initial taste of a whiskey, because it's so high in alcohol, a lot of people really just taste the alcohol. Mm-hmm. So what you want to do is hold it there for long enough, and you find that the flavor of the alcohol fades away, and a lot of the undertones and the subtleties and the nuances of the whiskey are going to start to come up. So it's always very important to hold it there, and we'll do that with each of the whiskeys every time, okay?
Okay. Already done that, and got the classic vanilla notes, got a little bit of the sweetness, and got the usual Jameson notes that... We've tasted many times before.
So again, it's just the two things I like to get through to people here is, I mean, firstly, the flavor. I mean, you don't have a whiskey with a good flavor, you don't have a whiskey worth talking about, you know? But this one, for me, and I mean, I'm about an 11, 12-year-old maybe Jameson drinking veteran at this point, but it's unmistakable, for me at least, a very, very distinctive taste. So, I mean, as you rightly said, very rich, very long-lasting as well, a very, very persistent aftertaste with this. And personally, for me, I always find that it's the aftertaste that you get a lot of the subtleties come through. And the one thing I love about this whiskey is that when you get into the process and you know the little ins and outs of how it's made, you can trace each of those flavors back to something specific in the process that's causing it, you know? Like you're getting the flavors of the malt, that slight biscuity sweetness that we talked about back at the start. The creaminess that's in there is actually something quite distinct to Jameson, and that's coming from the unmalted barley. Some people say a slight aromatic, slightly oily quality, which is coming from the copper pot stills, and then, as you so correctly said, the vanilla notes and the sweetness coming from the sherry and the bourbon barrels that we use through maturation. But then, I mean, part of the reason that it's such a popular whiskey worldwide now, I think, is partly to do with the smoothness as well. You know, it's not just about the taste. It's got that very soft and smooth quality, which is coming from the fact that we triple distill. And that's something that a lot of people don't notice with it straight away, but when we sit down and compare to the other two, they do start to notice the differences coming in there a little more as well. And I guess just the final point about the Jameson is that, you know, traditionally in this country, and it's something I'm sure you're well aware of, but traditionally in Ireland, whiskey's not mixed. There's always been this stigma that you drink it straight or it's almost you don't drink it at all. But for the original Jameson, that's something that's really, really starting to change. And you see, it's part of the reason it's become so popular worldwide now is that it's got the flavor for the whiskey purists, but it's got the smoothness, which gives it the versatility for long drinks and mixers and cocktails and Irish coffees. And like, we even do Jameson hot chocolate at the bar downstairs here. So, I mean, the one thing I like to explain to people here is just that the only reason we're so specific about how it's made is so that our customers can drink it whatever way they choose to drink it, you know? Personally, I gotta say, I'm kind of a purist with these things, but if you find a way that you like it, that's the important thing to us. That's the way we want you to drink it. We like our own customers to find their own way with our whiskey, you know?
And while you were talking, I tasted the scotch.
Okay.
And got the creaminess off the top, but then that peaty note that kicked in.
Absolutely.
So I'm not going to hazard a guess as to which scotch it is, and it's not labeled on here, but it had the peatiness on there, and I suspect it was selected for a reason because it has the peaty flavor as well. But you get this nice contrast between the two by tasting them side by side.
And again, it's one of those little changes along the way. Like, even though this is, you know, a very, very long process when you consider all the years in the barrels, like, the choice of fuel in the fire on the very first day of production can have such a massive bearing onto the flavor. Now, bear in mind that the Jameson you tasted is our original whiskey. That's, on average, a five-year-old Jameson. The scotch you're comparing to is the best-selling brand of scotch worldwide, which is Johnny Walker. But apart from you, instead of using the Johnny Walker Red, which is technically the best-selling scotch whiskey worldwide, we're using the Black Label, which is the 12-year-old here. So we are, you know, we're raising the bar for ourselves here and comparing to something almost twice the age of our whiskey. But, I mean, as you so rightly say, you get that peaty note coming through on the flavour, coming from the way they dry the malt over the open fire. But the other difference we like to explain to people here as well is the different feel. You know, the Jameson has that extra smoothness and that extra mellow note down to the fact that it's a triple distilled whiskey compared to the Scotch or the Johnny Walker, which is a double distilled. And really, the final thing we like to explain to people here is that while Black Label is what they refer to as a blended whiskey, Jameson is now in another category, another niche called a single distillery whiskey, just meaning that every single drop is produced under the same roof and watched over and controlled by the same master distiller, you know?
But as opposed to a single malt, because it's not made of 100% malted
precisely,
barley.
Yes, so it is. A lot of people have that conception that it has to be either single malt or blend, whereas in reality Jameson is falling into that slightly smaller third category that not a lot of people have heard of before, you know.
And now I'm nosing the American whiskey and getting those the classic dark chocolate, vanilla, caramel notes that.
Absolutely.
And I'm not going to hazard a guess, as since it's an American whiskey, I'm not hazarding a guess as to whether it's a bourbon or a Tennessee whiskey, but I suspect you'll tell me in a second here, and I'm going to do a little taste now.
There we go. Go right ahead. So again, we're comparing best-selling to best-selling here. So we're comparing to the best-selling American whiskey, which is a little brand called Jack Daniel's, which, you know, some people have heard of before, you know.
Yeah.
But obviously I'm saying that very much tongue-in-cheek, just since I'm being recorded here. But yeah, I mean, with the American whiskey, you're absolutely right. I mean, you get that much more pronounced more pronounced quality, both off the nose and the taste, which is down to a combination of things. The sweetness really coming from the fact that it's based on corn rather than on barley, so with it being a sweeter cereal, you are going to get a sweeter whiskey. And that both impacts the nose and the taste, I find. You'll get that much more sweeter quality coming from the aroma as well. Tends to be one distillation only for American whiskeys, so again, a very different feel and finish compared to the triple distilled Jameson. And then finally, something that you may be picking up on a little as well is the slightly floral, slightly perfumey notes coming from the nose, and the aftertaste particularly, I find, as well. And that's down to the practice in the States of using brand new wood. Like, as I said, for Jameson, we tend to use the seasoned barrels. In America, it's common practice to use a brand new barrel every single time you make it. So you find that because the wood is always so fresh, it is going to impart that quality into the whiskey as well. And with the Jack Daniels, you do notice it very much in the nose and the taste.
And regular listeners will note that back in February, we did the show from the Brown-Forman Cooperage where the barrels are made for Jack Daniels. And I would suspect that some of those barrels wound up here aging Jameson at some point.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, the last time I was down at the distillery, I saw maybe 8, maybe 9 different brands burned into the American barrels that are down there. So, as I said, it's more so that we use barrels coming from a specific cooperage rather than barrels coming from a specific bourbon company or anything like that over in the States. We'll actually be using them from all over America.
And I'm not going to say which one is the best.
Okay.
Because I've had all three of these, and they're all excellent whiskeys in their own rights, and they all have their own individual taste profiles, and it's not for me to say which one is the best here, but they all stand up very well against each other.
Absolutely, yeah, you know what I mean? And that's what's important to me. Like, it's usually we would ask each of our visitors here which one they preferred, you know, and not so much which one is best, but which one they themselves preferred as they go through. But for me, the important thing is that each of our visitors walks out of here today with some concept of what makes our whiskey a little different, a little distinct from the others that are out there too. And a lot of the misconceptions people have when they come in is, you know, when they say things like, I don't like whiskey, it's like, well, maybe you just haven't found the right one yet, you know? There's such a, like, whiskey is such an umbrella term, and that's part of the reason we like to do this as well, is to prove to people that there are so many subcategories under that, so many different flavors, so many different qualities and tastes. That's kind of what I like people to leave here with a grasp of, you know? And once our visitors have that, then I consider my job done, you know?
The Old Jameson Distillery is open almost every day for tours, and the gift shop sells a special bottling of Jameson that's only available at the distillery. There's also a distillery bottling available at the Jameson Visitors Center at Old Middleton Distillery in County Cork. The two are different. Makes it worthwhile to visit both places. The WhiskeyCast smartphone apps and the website have my tasting notes for many of the Jameson expressions. Now, Christopher mentioned the Jameson Rarest Vintage Reserve, and while I've previously done notes on the 2009 edition, I have not done them until now for the original 2007 bottling. Like the 2009, it's bottled at 46% ABV, but the nose has notes of grass, lemon peel, cinnamon, and nutmeg. The taste has a peppery spice with toasted oak, and as the pepperiness fades, there are notes of lemony tartness and dark chocolate that come out. The finish is long, warming, and rich with a good balance of tartness and sweetness. It's about $250 a bottle, if you can find it, and it's a very special whiskey. I'm scoring the 2007 Jameson Rarest Vintage Reserve a 95. By the way, I scored the 2009 edition a 93 when I tasted it last year. Now, the Jameson 18-year-old limited edition is bottled at 40% ABV. Easier to find, more affordable than the Rarest Vintage Reserve. It's about $80 a bottle, depending on where you shop. The nose is spicy and oily with a touch of wood and toffee sweetness. The taste is smooth, complex, and rich with toffee, hot fudge, and hints of vanilla, almonds, and oak. The finish is lingering and spicy with hints of caramel and chocolate. I'm scoring the Jameson 18-year-old a 93. Finally, I mentioned the Great King Street blended scotch from Compass Box earlier. I received a sample of it this week in advance of its U.S. debut later this month. It's bottled at 43% ABV. The nose is smooth with muted spices, including cinnamon, hazelnut, and nutmeg. There are grassy and floral notes, providing balance as well. The taste is rich and spicier than expected, but with a good balance. Cinnamon and hazelnut notes dominate, but there's also an aromatic airiness about it with a hint of brown sugar sweetness underneath. The finish is smooth and lingering. I'm scoring the Great King Street Artist's Blend a 90. Of course, you'll find all of my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast smartphone apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. They're free to download thanks to sponsorship from the Glenrothes for the Apple version and Benromic for the Android version. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, the photo gallery and print shop, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.